Luke 24, 25. Then he said unto them, O fools and slow of heart, to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And begin at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded them in all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. Nehemiah 8, verse 7 to 8. Caused people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place, so they read in the book in the law of God distinctly, and gave sense, the sense, and caused them to understand the reading. So that means that Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament anyway, we discovered that when we say Old Testament now, we have to be very careful in our use of grammar, not because of anything, but like we have said, the Bible is one book. From Genesis to Revelation, it has the same, different narratives, different characterization, but the same theology, different experiences. So, in the study of the Old Testament books, you can't escape your study of angels, for example, because of some main things that angels did. Now, let's touch a few things. In verse 44, Jesus thinks that the words I spoke to you while I was with you, all things must be fulfilled, were written in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms concerning me. 45, then he opened ye their understanding that they might understand the scriptures. Now, in Romans 15:4, I said that to say this, that so the Old Testament text must be handled in a doctrinal way. Doctrinal means exegetical explanation. There was someone who was trying to respond to something someone said. And it's about this concept of, can God kill? Can God not kill? Somebody says, God does not, listen to this part, this very in-depth explanation. God can kill, but he does not kill. So the question is, why does he not kill? They said, because he loves you. Okay? So, God would have, but he would not, because he loves you. You know, and the guy went into that, yes, the truth is that we should look at it. God could have saved Jesus from dying, but he did not. Not that he could not, but he did not. So, I thought, well, that's quite some thinking. That he could have saved him, but he did not, but eventually raised him from the dead. we went to bring a lot of narratives. And so the guy simply, what he did was, somebody talks about, let's assume a 13 series teaching. Then he just answers with a simple, very simple, simplistic, let me use the word, just put out six scriptures, and God destroyed, and this happened. Just six scriptures that this invalidates everything the other person said. I said, no. Even if the other person was wrong, excuse me, in his submission, you have done worse evil by putting different scenarios in the same bag. If you really want this thing to be clear to us, each text, you will explain it. And not just by quoting. You will go into the scenarios, the experiences, what happened, what eventually happened. Then we'll be rest assured as to what we're talking about. So, the concept of angels will follow the same pattern. There's no way you could have taught the Old Testament and ignored a very prevalent ministry of angels. You can't. So in Romans 15 verse 4, the writer says, whatsoever things were written aforetime, prographo now, used for the Old Testament, same as Galatians 3:1, were written for our doctrine. Learning there is doctrine, the didaskalia, that we through the patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. 2 Timothy 3:16 or 3:15, from a child you have known the holy scriptures, which are able to make thee wise unto salvation through faith that is in Christ. All scripture is given by inspiration of God, profitable for doctrine, didaskalia, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. Look at 1 Corinthians 10. So there is doctrine in all the experience of the Old Testament. It doesn't mean that the entire narratives will bring about faith. I didn't say that. But there is doctrine. And when you look, use the word doctrine for whatsoever things were written. And you notice that what he was referring to was talking about bearing the infirmities of the weak. Then he uses Psalm 69 verse 9. And a psalm of David talking about his own personal experiences. So which means that the doctrine, alright, takes in all the characters, all the events. Everything written should be explained in a doctrinal, systematic fashion. Let me put, I said 1 Corinthians 10. Verse 6. Now these things were examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. Verse 11. Now all these things happened unto them as examples, and they were written for admonition upon whom the ends of the world, that's the word telos, the goal of the ages have arrived. So how would you ignore the subject of angels? We can't do that. And so we began to look at angels, and I wanted to also do it very slowly. Let me remind us of a few things we have said. Use of words, Elohim, Eloha. And I said the word Eloha is from the Ugaritic mode of communication, an extinct dialect among the Amorites. It's similar to what we have, what we can also call the Mesopotamian language. And oftentimes, Jewish scholars go back to the Mesopotamian texts, the Ugaritic explanations, to clarify Hebrew language. Don't forget that there's a distinction between the Israelite and the Hebrew. Of course, the Israelite came from the Hebrew lineage, but not every Hebrew is Israelite. So, oftentimes you have, of course, also within the Egyptian writing format, it's called the hieroglyphs. Hieroglyphs, H-I-E-R-O-G-L-Y-P-H-S. Ancient Israel used this kind of writings. Where the word Elohim was derived from, Elohim is used for supernatural beings or something higher. So it's used for judges, governors. And this word has about 2,500, I think, in phrases in the Hebrew scriptures. The gods of Egypt were called Elohim, Exodus 12:12. Gods, 1 Kings 11:33, 1 Samuel 28:13. Moses was called a god to Aaron, who was his elder brother, or his brother, Exodus 4:16. And I mentioned the use of the word Bene Elohim, Ugaritic, Phoenician text, used for a council of gods. Or council of supernatural beings. And we also note that Moses wrote in Hebraism, that has his own mode of communication, and the way it expresses itself. We also noted that in ancient language, oftentimes a messenger is given the first person pronoun of the one who sent him, which unites those who proclaim a message from the person they represent. There are texts, for example, that you will find Yahweh not absent, not present. There are texts you find Yahweh is there, which the reason is because in the Near East tradition, deities are supposed to speak directly, even when they speak through representatives. Now, when Moses cries in Exodus 3, "Show me thy face, show me your glory," that should clear the air, you know, that he had much correspondences with angels and did want to see God's face or the manifestation of God. That shows us that the theophany concept, therefore, is misplaced. How Christ is supposed to have appeared, you know, in different forms. That's just for the background. So in our study of the Old Testament, language becomes critical where we separate the pronouns from the actors. And we'll look at the use of phrases and all of that. Look at Psalm 8. Psalm 8:4. What is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the Elohim, and crowned him with glory and honor. Thou made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. And you have the word Elohim there, which we have already said is used for judges and gods. So a little lower than Elohim there, will have a couple of concepts, and I think we should explore it. The King James will say angels, which is clear, a little lower than angels, but we can expand the narrative to also say, well, it was made, you know, like Galatians 4:3 says, under the law, and 4, it was made, you know, brought under judges, magistrates, basically saying that Jesus became a man and made subservient, as it were, to human government. Hebrews 2, which we'll go to shortly, alright, John 10:35, where Jesus did say something like this. He quoted Psalm 82:6. "You are gods, all of you children of the Most High." You just need to read the background. The word God says Elohim. God stands in the condition of the mighty. He judges among the gods, Elohim. "How long shall you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Defend the poor, fatherless, do justice to the afflicted and needy, deliver the poor, needy, rid them out of the hand of the wicked." Okay, so let's extract this. Verse 2-4 will be a Sedeka. This is the right, or Sedeka, or Sadiq, the righteous judgment, which we have explored before. The unjust thing is to accept the persons of the wicked, welcome the wicked. Rather, it says what you ought to do is defend the poor and the fatherless, do justice to the afflicted and needy, deliver the poor and needy, rid them out of the hand of the wicked. Verse 5, "They know not, neither do they understand, they walk not on in darkness." Those are unjust judges. "All the foundations of the earth are out of course. I have said you are judges, all of you children of the Most High. But you die like men." That is, your judgment ought to reflect how God judges. "And fall like one of the priests. Arise, O God, judge the earth, and thou shalt inherit all the nations." So, verse 8. Can we say verse 8 is God's righteousness? Huh? Alright. Elohim is used there. And Jesus says, "Is it not written in your law?" Don't forget, that is not the first 5 books. Rather, it's the book of Psalms. So back to the Psalm 8:4-6, we look at the interpretation that the psalmist, I mean, the writer of Hebrews gives to it. Writer of Hebrews 2. "For unto which of the angels hath For unto the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come, whereof we speak. Now, the world to come is this world now, the age, alright, what you call eternal life. But when a certain place testifies, saying, what is man that thou art mindful of him, nor the son of man that you visit him? So the first thing he says is that God didn't put angels in charge of anything. That's the first commentary by this, I mean, he's interpreting Psalm 8 verse 4 to 6. Then he says, you have made me a little lower than the angels, thou art crowned with glory and honor, and thou set him over the works of your hands. Genesis 1:26-28 is in view there. So the glory of God is through man, not angels. Put all things under his feet, for in that he put all things under him, verse 8, he left nothing that is put under him, but now we see not yet all things put under him. Once again, that issue of subjection will have the Genesis 3:15. Your seed will bruise the head of the serpent and then bruise the heel. So he says this is for man, not angels. Then, verse 16. That is, the Savior did not take on him angels. Rather, he took on him the body of the seed of Abraham. That's three things he has said. The fourth, he says, an heir. So there's no utterance calling the angel an heir. Rather, Hebrews 1:14, he is sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation. No doubt what the writer of Hebrews is doing is that he's spelling out authority amongst God's creation, salvation, prophetic utterances, the nature of the Savior, and the actual duties of angels. In Hebrews 1:14, it says, they are sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation. Apostelomena, diatos, melontas, cleromonian, soteria. Apostelomena shows you a present, abiding, sending forth, diatos, melontas, who shall be, that is, a future event, heirs of salvation, will be, in the Old Testament, they are called to inherit salvation, which will be Israel, naturally, and now the whole world. The believer today is now the heir of salvation. Who shall be heirs of salvation? Cleromonian soteria. Now, a key word there is the one sent to minister for. Again, as passingly as this phrase may look like, sometimes it is just what is needed to do the proper interpretation. The word is the word dia. D-I-A. Some Greek versions will have it as just D-I. Dia means on account of. On account of, because of, by, or through. So, with this commentary on the writer of Hebrews, we have no doubt that angels were to walk through man and vice versa. Because it's almost like, oh, God is sending angels to man every minute and every... No. He's summarizing the work of angels in the Old Testament by saying, angels walk with man. On account of. Through. We read something earlier in Daniel 10. Verse 12, I am come for thy words. I want to just, this is like jumping, but just a quick reference to Revelation 12, where the angel said, no, 19, sorry. S- I fell at his feet to worship him, 19:10. And he said, see that you do it not. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren. Alright? Which is a strange Greek word, almost like I'm a servant like you. No. I am a fellow servant of you, or a servant of you and of your brethren. So, something key here is the work of angels. I am your servant. Revelation 2:19. See, you do it not the second time, for I am the fellow servant and of your brethren, the prophets, and of them which keep the sayings of this book, worship God. So that's critical in theology about angels. So the writer of Hebrews systematically says, look, angels were sent forth to minister on account of man or by man. So there is no way the ministry of angels would not be seen through men and women of the Old Testament. To distinguish angels in any sense of being perfect beings from imperfect man is to totally alter the reason for redemption. So that is important. Now let's look at the commentaries around Jesus. In Matthew 4 and angels. Matthew 4, we find angels coming to minister unto Jesus, verse 11, when he fasted. Matthew 4, verse 11. Matthew 20, no. John 18. Now let's just get his commentary. In John 18:36, and I need you to listen to this echo. John 18:36, my world or my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I would not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. My servants there would refer primarily to his disciples. My kingdom is not of this world. He didn't say it is not for this world. Okay. I've told you to always make that distinction. So, he said, then would they fight? So, in other words, he does make a distinction on what his servants are meant to do. Now, in the events that led up to the cross, Matthew 26, verse 53, think thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels. Now, if you stop at that point, the question will be, he could have just called angels to come and destroy, you know. But that would be taking his words out of context. Let's see what preceded that commentary. The word he will give angels there, presently give is the word paristemi. P-A-R-I-S-T-M-E-I. It makes to be on the standby. A standby position. I want to say I can call on my Father, parakaleo. Means to speak to, besides, to ask to come and help. But those are not even the key issues. Look at 52. This was when Peter, you know, struck the ears of one of the high priest's servants. And he said in 52, put again the sword into your place. For all they that take the sword shall perish by the sword. And I need you to understand that when it says they there, the word is H-O in the Greek, that which can also be those that, but we can choose the former. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword, Perish is the word apolumi, a word used for destruction. So those who says take the sword shall perish by the sword. Then the next statement, think thou that I cannot pray to my father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legion of angels. Now, you know therefore that he couldn't have been saying, so that my servants or the angels will kill my persecutors. That will contradict what he says in 52. Those who use the sword shall perish with the sword. That will contradict what he said in 52. But look at 54. But how then shall the scriptures be fulfilled? This must be. This is the key point. Then 54. First, we feel, okay, which is the word plero, plerothenia, plerothosian, just it will be done. So scriptures are fulfilled by angels not protecting Jesus. Scriptures are fulfilled by angels. But then we have incidences where angels protected people. So when it says the scriptures are fulfilled there, we need to understand what he's referring to. The work of the Messiah's death cannot happen if angels are there at the behest of deliverance. Then he says in 55, are you come out as against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and you laid no hold on me. But this was done that the scriptures of the prophet, that is everything together. Now, of course, this shouldn't be studied in isolation, which simply means here that the angels have not come to my aid. Why? So that the scriptures might be fulfilled. So, which means, pay attention, where we find injustice, where we find what happened to Jesus happened, or let me put it, where we find death, where we find turmoil, like we see oftentimes, is saying, is because the angels were not protecting. And why did we say that? Because the death of Jesus, according to what we have read earlier, Acts 2:23, Psalm 22 verse 1, Matthew 27 verse 46 says that he gave up his son. John 3:16, a word used for abandonment, not to be involved in. It's used for betrayal too. Now, recall what was earlier explained from Romans 1:26-32. He gave them up, which is the wrath of God. So when we say the wrath of God on Jesus, it simply meant there was no protective power. It doesn't mean that God is doing something. So when we say the scriptures are being fulfilled, it doesn't mean God is doing something. Or it could just mean God is doing something by doing nothing. Who's following what I'm saying here? So the scriptures were fulfilled when Jesus hung on the cross, and God did not put him on the cross. But God put him on the cross by not putting him on the cross. So, here, the giving up of Jesus to die is scriptures fulfilled. Now, I must add this. Angels simply responded to Jesus' obedience. asserting what we said earlier about ministering for those who shall be heirs of salvation. So they are responding to Jesus' obedience. Now let me add this. It also means that they respond to disobedience, which we also can call the wrath of God. Jesus' obedience, was it the wrath of God? Yes. Israel's disobedience, is it the wrath of God? Yes. So it therefore annuls the concept of angels kill, which we will rule out. Rather, it asserts that Jesus chose not to be protected. From the commentaries of Jesus, angels protect and angels might not protect or will not protect where the wrath of God is mentioned. Again, that's expanding the narrative. By the time you look at the death of Jesus and what happened and saw, what, my God, why have you forsaken me? That is, why didn't angels come and help? Psalm 22 verse 1, Matthew 27 verse 46, which means you abandoned, you allowed these guys to take me. So angels will simply be present and do nothing. Why? Because of Jesus' obedience and because of the disobedience of the men. So we find angels inactive in that scenario because of the men's disobedience and because of the obedience of Jesus, both found in the wrath of God. The second commentary we'll find is Matthew 22. I'm not taking it in any particular order. Matthew 22, when they ask Jesus about the resurrection, about whose wife will this person be, if a man dies, verse 24, having no children, his brother shall marry his wife. This is Jeremiah 25, verse 5. Then they said, then after the seventh one, they didn't have a child, said, last of all, the woman died. And they said that, in the resurrection, whose wife shall he be of the seven? Then he says, you do here, 29, and not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. Now, let's expand this narrative. But touching the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. So the promise of life is where you find God. The promise of life. In other words, he sustains his promises through the resurrection. But a key thing is that they are not given in marriage to, because the issue was having children, there was no children, no marriage, for procreation. So within that we see that angels were never, listen to this, the promise to Adam was not for angels. And God's multiplying is in the earth. His multiplying is in the earth. Angels will multiply. The echoes of marriage in Genesis 2:24, Genesis 2:18. So angels will multiply. That shows that the promise is to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is not to angels. When I say I'm God, not of the dead, but of the living, it simply meant that God's promise to them is fulfilled here on earth. And when you look at that promise made to them, is that their seed will inherit the earth. Again, expand your narrative very well. So, no doubt, he's making another distinction. And you've seen, we have seen a couple of things making a distinction between God and angels, God and man. So there is a clear-cut distinction there again about angels and man. Matthew 18:10, That's about little children. It says, take it that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you, that in heaven their angels do always behold their face, the face of my Father, which is in heaven. Of course, the concept of heaven is simply in the spirit, in God's work on earth. Use the word blepo, prospon. Verse 11 now says, for the Son of Man is come to save that which is lost. Look at, so 11 captures that. Then he talks about, if a man has 100 sheep, the way this is in Matthew, shows again that angels walk towards the plan of salvation. Matthew 8, 10 and 11. So far in the commentaries of Jesus, which is the righteousness of God, we find angels spoken of in saving acts. Saving acts. We find angels being distinguished from man. In Acts 12, book of Acts, now this is dealing with superstition now. When Herod was eaten up of worms and gave up the ghost, I told you the word eaten up of worms doesn't mean that he was on the floor. Then they were seeing worms around him. Simply means he died of a disease. And they said that the angel of the Lord smote him because he gave not God the glory. Now, this is presumptive. And obviously, a belief system. Because nobody saw an angel. In Acts 5, Peter saw the angel. In Acts 12, Peter saw the angel. In Acts 27, Paul saw the angel. The question is, who saw this angel? It's obviously, it's one of those assumptions. Look at John 12. When Jesus said, in 28, Father, glorify thy name. Then there came a voice from heaven saying, I've both glorified it again. People therefore stood by and heard it. And they said, an angel spoke to him. An angel spoke to him. Submit that this is what have happened. What have happened in Acts 12, verse 23. Now, there's also the concept of angels. I should have said this earlier, which they also use for extraterrestrial beings. They use it for ghosts. For example, when Peter came from jail and then Rhoda saw him and came back and said, I saw Peter. And they said, it is his angel. Verse 15. It is his angel. In other words, it is his ghost. It is something that looks like him. It is his spirit. Now, I find echoes of what happened to of what happened to Herod in 1 Samuel 25, verse 38. It came to pass after 10 days that the Lord smote Nabal that he died. Look at verse 37. It came to pass in the morning when the wine was gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, that his heart died within him and he became as a stone. So he had what you can call a cardiac arrest. Can you see? 1 Samuel 12, 37, 38. He had like a cardiac arrest and he said the Lord smote him. 2 Samuel 24. Verse 17. This is David. David spake unto the Lord when he saw that the angel that smote the people and said, lo, I've sinned and I've done wickedly. Of course, you find out that we've already identified that 2 Samuel 24, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. He moved David against them. Years later, when Ezra purportedly wrote this, in 2 Chronicles 21:1, he says it was Satan. So we see incidences again here where Satan did something and said, the Lord's angel, why would he say that? Well, maybe he's referring to a withdrawal. The Lord's angel didn't do anything, or this happened, and all. But then the angel of the Lord here obviously had to do with what the devil had done. Acts 27, Paul says the angel of God stood and gave him message and obviously rescued everybody in the ship. Acts 27 verse 22 through to 25. So like I said, in John 12, we see a theology of the people. So the phrase angel obviously has a bigger connotation among the Jews for spirit beings, ghosts. Look at Acts 6. Stephen, when he started preaching, Acts 6, all that sat in the council looked steadfastly on him and saw his face as it had been the face of an angel. That's the face of Stephen. The face of an angel. So that means in the night of the four gospels, we have the commentaries of Jesus, the book of Acts, we have a shade of the theories and theologies, as it were, of the Jewish nation. Acts 12 is definitely Jews, Herod and all of that. So it's believed that it was a judgment of God, that's why he fell ill and all of that. So we therefore can say that the concept of supernatural incidences has a threefold thinking. One, there are incidences where God didn't do anything, alright, and the angels didn't do anything, and men who were the deliverers of Israel at that point didn't do anything. And there are incidents and evil happened. Hosts of armies killed people, destroyed them. There are also incidents where we can see that there is also an Hebraism culture of using a third party as the main actor. The angel of the Lord did not protect. The angel of the Lord smote. Interwoven. There's also something that we might have to deal with. It's a very slippery area. That could the angels also have acted on man's instructions, where, for example, Israel went to war and killed people? Could angels have done that too? It's a very, very huge possibility, and therefore we must exploit. Those three things will lie within. So the use of angels will also be embedded with the, can we call it, the superstitions that are also in the nation of Israel. So the epistles. Second Corinthians 11. So in saying this, where we have a form of difficulty between the distant world of the Old Testament writers, closer to us will be the New Testament writers. Why? Because the Greek language is closer to the English language than the Hebraism. So, if Jesus interprets the Old Testament in his day in the Aramaic, and consequently the Greek that we now know, and then the writers of the epistles have done the same, that means we must take their interpretation. Because, like we said, it's a mixed grill. And go to that world to sort it out. We have to sort it out. I said there are three scenarios. One, where God did nothing, angel did nothing. Alright? Two, where angels did not act and thereby acted, Then it was said, angels did it. Or the angel of the Lord did it by not doing it. Hebraism, we said. Hebraism. Then the third scenario, which is a possibility, we said, where angels simply acted on the instructions of the men who sent them. We are therefore left with such thinking. We have to deal with the three possibilities. The first thing is that we shouldn't get our minds to assume that angels cannot err. That is something that is a wrong theology. If God's servants can err, okay, err ignorantly, err, how much more the servants of his servants? Who, the only thing is that it will be a vicarious liability. That is the error, it is not the sins of the fathers on the children now, it is the sins of the children on the fathers. Or the sins of the servant, or he who sent him. So, or he who, or whom he walked through, will be a critical point. So, what are those three scenarios that we are going to explore all together? But let's follow up with the New Testament commentaries, like I said earlier. In 2 Corinthians 11, now the context of this is subtlety being beguiled by Satan, Genesis 3, and then verses 4, those who preach another gospel, Genesis 5. So in Genesis 4, verse 5, 2 Corinthians 11, 3, 4, 5, then verse 14. 13 already says, such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ, and no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. The word here is the word metashematizo. Metashematizo. Of course, when Paul is saying this now, because of the context we have here, is referring to the Old Testament. So that means in the Old Testament, he will be transformed as a messenger of light. 1 Corinthians 4:6, transfigured. Philippians 3:21. But 2 Corinthians 11:13, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. 2 Corinthians 11:15, his ministers also transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. So it means to take up another form. Galatians 4:14, and my temptation which was in my flesh, you despised not, nor rejected, but received me as an angel of God, even as Jesus Christ, as an angel of God. So, in other words, he's saying here that they will be received as angels of light. Obviously, this is an Old Testament fact. And then a New Testament fact, the way that Satan would disguise as an angel of light. Genesis 3 is an example of that. Galatians 1, if we are an angel, eight, preach another gospel. So therefore he makes us see that Satan can also function like an angel. And obviously demons. 1 Corinthians 4:9. I think God has set forth the apostles last, to be appointed for death, for we have made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels and to men. A spectacle. In 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 3, we shall, know you not that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? So, the word is much critical here. The word krino, where you have krino, krisis, make a distinction, sort out, and all of that. The 1 Corinthians 11, verse 10, for this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of angels, on account of angels, which we said, we have no gender. We've done that study before. The 1 Corinthians 13:1, I speak in tongues of an angel, which is figurative. So, the commentaries we have so far on angels doesn't place them in a superior ranking of intelligence, superior ranking of authority whatsoever. If at all that view comes up, it's a superstition. That view will be a superstition. So superstitions we need to deal with are very critical. One, angels are not perfect servants. They are servants of God's servants. Two, angels can easily be duplicated, just like ministers of the gospel today, by demons. Three, angels equally will be absent where the wrath of God is present. Now that may now have exceptions. The exceptions are the things we are going to also explore. So no commentary of the New Testament figures angels as having what you can call an equal right or privilege with man. That already shows you how to reason the ministry of angels. Because if you don't do that, that superstitious belief that, okay, angels, you know, have this, don't blame me, I'm not an angel. We even say it in our conversations, showing you that superstition does have a say in how many people reason. So when the angel in Revelation 19:10 and 22:9 says, I am your fellow servant, is he saying we are servants together? No. There was nowhere angels and man are called co-servants. He's simply saying, you know, I am amongst many servants of you and your brethren. So I think the word there is son doulos. I am with others as a servant. I'm not even the only one. So, the way you shouldn't worship me, don't worship any other angel. So, we therefore must clarify that, you know, within the concept of... It's a slippery ground. But, if we look at the exegesis and hermeneutic of the epistles and the four gospels, we shouldn't be afraid to call a spade a spade. Like we have said, they can be transformed as angels of light, demons. And we also said that angels are not in same authority or spiritual authority or ranking with man. So that shows you a couple of things that must be well addressed. So our when it comes with angels, our guidepost, majorly, just like any other doctrine though, is at the epistles and the four gospels. They will be. The reason is that because of the supernatural nature of the work of angels vis-a-vis demons, it is the four gospels that make that distinction. Where there's bondage and sicknesses, Jesus calls them demons. Like I said, the concept of demons and demons came after the prophets were already concluded. It was the interpreters of the Old Testament, the scribes that we mentioned the other time, were the ones that gave Satan, they even had the satanic devil, those strict names, to in what I call in reformed or revealed language barriers, usages. So when Jesus was casting out demons, where the sicknesses were healed, and where people even spoke against him, and he said it was the devil, Matthew 12, where they insulted his name, and all that. What he was basically saying is, don't allow demons to be transformed to an angel of light. So he was making a distinction. Like 1 John 5, it says, 3:8, for this purpose the Son of God made manifest that he may destroy. The word luo means to untie the works of the devil. So Jesus himself, in his teaching and ministry, made that clarification. Like I said, because they were supernatural beings, it was clear to say, no, this is the devil. Like somebody was arguing about John 10:10, and he says, well, the thief cometh to steal, to kill, and to destroy, that it is not the devil. Remind me to write something about that on Facebook today. I'll try to do it. And he says that it's not the devil. And you know, sometimes you can be excited about that. It's not the devil, because you've always said it's the devil. So you say, but is there anything wrong in even calling the devil a thief? I don't think anybody should become the defense of the devil and say, he's not the thief, he's not the thief. He has enough people that work for him. But then, by the time you say, it is referring to the Pharisees and Sadducees, have you not said it's the devil eventually? Are you following what I'm saying? But the Pharisees and Sadducees were they are the princes of this world with the prince of this world. So at the end of the day, if the Pharisees and Sadducees killed and destroyed, that is through the work of the devil. Which is what I just said now. What have we done now? We have had that's an expansive theology. Not just looking at the text and the immediate context, but the overall concept. Is that very clear? Because every time the Pharisees and Sadducees tempted Jesus, Matthew said Satan came to him. So whatever they were doing was the work of the devil. All of these things are things that, you know, require a lot of careful explanation. What else did Paul say about angels? Colossians 2. Colossians 2:18. Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshipping of angels. The word angelos treskia. Treskia. Where you have devotion. Acts 26 verse 5. James 1:27-28. Devotion. Treskia. Worship of angels. Okay, I've seen it. The text I was looking for, I saw it now. I said, we'll take this tomorrow. I put it. Because where did I throw this stuff? So there is, now why does he call it the worship of angels? Observe what he's referring to. In verse 16, meat and drink, holy day, new moon, Sabbath, which we said is located in Egyptian mode of worship. Can you remember that? The Near Eastern. So he's saying here that there is shadow of things, skia, of things to come. But the body is of Christ. So therefore, don't get yourself puffed up using physical elements for things that your mind has not seen. Taste not, touch not, handle not, and all of that. Now, of course, in this concept, don't forget that the issue with Colossae wasn't just the law. They had syncretism, they had that's the law, Judaism, new age, everything was together. So they all found a common ground in ceremonies. 2 Thessalonians 1:7, Paul says Christ will come with his mighty angels. He had archangels. 1 Thessalonians 5:16. Then 1 Timothy 3:16. Seen of angels. That's Christ in his walk. God was made manifest, justified in the Spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received of him glory. Seen of angels simply means that in his incarnation he was seen of angels. 1 Timothy 5:21, the elect angels of God. Then the book of Hebrews will be a wider commentary. We have done a bit of that. Hebrews 1:4. Hebrews 1:5, 6, 7, 13. Hebrews 2:2. Hebrews 2:5. Hebrews 2:7, 9, and 16. Hebrews 1:4. Hebrews 1:5. Hebrews 1:6. Hebrews 1:7. Hebrews 1:13. Hebrews 2:2. Hebrews 2:5. Hebrews 1:7. Sorry, 2:7. 2:9 and 2:16. Then Hebrews 12:22. Innumerable company of angels. Hebrews 13:2. Some entertain angels unawares. 1 Peter 1:12, which the talking about the gospel, said which the angels desire to look into. 1 Peter 3:22, Jesus is gone unto heaven, the right hand of God. He said angels, authorities and powers being made subject unto him. The 2 Peter 2:4, the angels that sinned, and then Jude 6. Angels that kept not their first estate. Now, because let me mention this very well. Every time the epistles are referring to angels, they are teaching from where? The Old Testament. So, in the Old Testament, was man made subject to angels? No. Were angels sent to minister through man? Yes. Were the sights and shadows aided by ministry of angels? Yes. In the Old Testament, did we have the elect angels of God? Yep. The archangel? Yep. In the Old Testament, were the angels of the Old Testament the one being referred to as looking into the gospel? Yes. Is Christ above angels and power? Yes. The angels that sinned? Yep. That left their first estate? Yes. So, Galatians 3:19, well, that's a footnote by which we'll take up tomorrow. Galatians 3:19. Wherefore then serveth the Lord was hardened because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. Look at the concept. It says a promise was given, alright, to Abraham to be carried out through Israel. Israel failed, alright, became unfaithful, angels came in, alright, and then the law said, but that law does not annul the promise that was given. So there's enough commentary for you not to overstate the, shall I say, authority or thereabouts of angels. The New Testament gives you enough commentary not to have an overbloated opinion of angels. Revelation 1:20, are gone angels. So, the basic thing here is, we have that commentary strong enough about angels in the Old Testament, taken from a language that is closer to our English language, that these angels were servants. These angels were working via man or working with man. So we cannot teach angels outside the men of the Old Testament. It has to be taught together. Let me see if you understand what I just said now. You have to explain it together. To explain angels only as with God is a careless theology. It has to be with man. And that is the reason why the writers of the commentaries were very emphatic on no, they are not higher. Man is higher. Christ is higher. Man is higher. The promises to man, not to angels. excellent name. They were clear commentaries in our viewpoints. And that should be clear enough. 15 minutes again.